Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to another episode of Real Science Friday. I'm Bob Enyart.
And I'm Fred Williams, software engineer and creation speaker.
So what's in the news?
Richard Dawkins, he's a friend of Creation Ministry, right?
No. Richard Dawkins is an atheist evolutionist.
Yeah, he's their propagandist media guy, basically.
Yeah.
Well, I understand that he's actually proven creationist correct.
He proved a creationist right.
Yeah.
This is funny. So should we hear this? Fred, back in 1997, a caller called into Bob Enyart Live and said, hey, well, Richard Dawkins, his books, they show the evidence for evolution. I said, no, they don't, actually. He just assumes evolution. He's like a politician giving a speech. He's not doing science showing the evidence for evolution. He's a salesman. He's a pitchman.
Exactly. And it's amazing how many evolutionists would appeal to that.
Yeah. And they throughout my career on the air, people tell me, well, read Richard Dawkins. That's why you're ignorant. You don't know the evidence. You don't. And I said, I do read Dawkins. Do you? Well, no, I never have.
Well, I'd love to hear this. I think we've got a sound clip coming up.
Yeah, we do. From Dawkins and then from 1997.
Oh, okay, great.
Let's hear Richard Dawkins.
My previous books have all been about evolution, but not the evidence for it. They've just assumed that evolution is true.
Oh, Fred!
I think it might confirm that 1997 claim you made.
Yeah, and still, it was still true 13 years later. So now, let's hear this audio from way back when in the 90s.
I'd like to suggest a book for your reading, and you could perhaps discuss it on the air.
Yeah.
It's called Climbing Mount Improbable.
Yeah, by Dawkins.
By Dawkins.
Richard
Dawkins.
Yeah.
And it is being touted at this point as one of the most complete explanations of the theory of evolution.
I have read Dawkins' work. For example, he wrote The Selfish Gene years ago.
Yeah, that's it.
And The Blind Watchmaker. And he is the furthest thing in the world from a thoughtful scientist.
Huh.
He's like a science fiction writer.
I have never read any of his work.
He thinks, evolutionists worship him. He thinks because he can make an analogy, he's proved a point.
Mm.
Read any of his books, and you'll see that he is not a scientist who's laying out evidence. I'd say that was right on a decade ago.
Oh, and you're absolutely right. You know, what he did was he would provide analogies, but
right. That's
not evidence for a theory. In fact, I remember some of the analogies he presented, and they were really shallow, like his methinks it is a weasel.
Methinks it is a weasel.
And we both have experience in computer engineering, and you can guarantee that that's going to happen by writing a program that...
Especially the way they wrote it.
Exactly.
It was
guaranteed to happen. It was 100% certainty.
Right.
That, by even Shannon's low-level definition of information, is not an increase in information, because you're guaranteeing the outcome with a program that was written by intelligent people.
Right, which was way more sophisticated than the rudimentary challenge they gave themselves. Fred, on our website, kgov.com, we offer $2,000 if somebody wants to take a program we have called Evolve and run it and get 16 letters to come out in the right order, not 16 in a row, but any 16 of the alphabet in its right slot by random chance. And we gave out $500 that for 14. Then somebody got 15. We gave out $1,500. Now we're offering $2,000 to get those letters right. And Fred, this has taken people over a decade, and eventually it will take billions of years when the number gets high enough in the alphabet just to get the letters in the right spots.
Yep. So his analogy was wrong, and I think a creationist was proven right.
Yeah, that Dawkins didn't, his books didn't include evidence. Let's hear from Dawkins himself proving a creationist right.
My previous books have all been about evolution, but not the evidence for it. They've just assumed that evolution is true.
From the spokesman for evolution.
The spokesman for evolution, and that claim was about Dawkins. And Fred, millions of people around the world during those decades, they assumed evolution was true because Richard Dawkins proved it in his books. I mean, he was their hero, their spokesman. And just this week, I got to interview an atheist, Hemant Mehta. He believes in evolution and Darwinism, and I asked him a couple things. It's like he never heard of it, and he said, I don't study evolution. So he trusts it by authority. He believes that Richard Dawkins has proved it, and so on.
Did he at least read Richard Dawkins' book that doesn't have evidence?
So. Where do we go from there, Fred?
Okay, well, there's an article in the Creation magazine that we were going through on our last show. We've got some more articles
That's
to go through.
That's right, the winter 2011 edition of Creation magazine at creation.com.
Right.
What a great magazine. So what article do you want to look at?
Well, let's look at robots and consciousness.
Robots and consciousness. I just love this article, Fred.
Oh, I bet you did. Don't you have a background in artificial intelligence?
Despite what my wife might claim about artificial intelligence, I studied this topic at Arizona State University. I had the opportunity to write a chess program and study other artificial intelligence concepts. It was a lot of fun. But Fred, there are many around the world who think that computers and robots are getting smarter and smarter, and eventually they will become conscious. They'll be self-aware, sentient beings, and they think the evidence is all around us that that's happening.
And it's promoted by Hollywood with movies like Terminator about how this computer takes over the world.
Oh, yeah, and aren't there
become
even
self-aware. That's what they say in the movie.
Self-aware, and even in Star Wars and Star Trek, right?
Yeah, C-3PO.
C-3PO.
And Data on Star Trek.
Data.
The Next Generation.
Who is a favorite character of millions, Data, because he's a creation that then is self-aware. That all of humanity would love to be able to do that, you know? And it's because God did it. And in a little way, maybe in a nice way, we're sort of envious.
Yeah.
It's like, hey, I'd like to be able to, in addition to procreation, of course.
In this article, it mentions one of the top AI researchers in the world. His name is Noel Sharkey. He's a professor of artificial intelligence at the University of Sheffield in the United Kingdom.
Cool. He thinks that robots and computers are becoming self-aware.
Well, actually, no. He says that these are fairy tales. And he's making a lot of his colleagues mad.
Because he's pointing out what? What assumption are they making? They think that we're getting there. You know, our computers are starting to become aware.
Yeah, and he says there's no evidence for this whatsoever. He talks about how you can make, you can kind of use trickery and illusion to create or make a program where a robot recognizes, say, a facial expression such as happiness. And then you can make the computer recognize this facial expression and then smile back at you. Or, you know, maybe you've got a sad expression.
So the robot, so you got vision systems and face recognition systems. And so they could look at a photograph and they could say, here are three faces in this photograph. And then once you could do that, you could have them look at the mouth area. And if the mouth is pointed up or down, and if people are smiling, the robot, you could make the image on the screen smile. That's an illusion that the computer knows what it's doing, but the computer doesn't even know that it's a computer.
It doesn't. It would do really good at Simon Says games. You know, Simon Says, stick out your tongue, and, you know, if it's going to mimic everything you do,
right,
it'd be kind of fun to mess around with a robot like that, but it's not self-aware.
So
it's computation.
In order for scientists to make a computer that's self-aware, some kind of an android, could we talk about that for a moment?
Sure.
You're an engineer. Could you pull together a team, Fred, to make something like Data? Let's say you wanted it to hear, to be able to hear. Could you give it some kind of a system where it could take in sound waves?
Yeah, you could take in, you could write a program that detects certain sound waves and then make some computations based on what it hears
to
do some action.
What if somebody was speaking to it? Could it possibly take that audio and decipher words, at least in some rudimentary way?
Yeah, sure. The word jump, and then you could make the motors and the legs jump the robot.
So you say jump, and on the way up, he says how high.
Yeah, that's right.
So we could trade in our kids for these things. And
you can tell him to jump over that bridge, and he'll see the bridge visually, and the program will then make his legs move, and he'll jump over the bridge.
Yeah, if somebody says jump off the cliff, you're going to jump off the cliff?
Yeah, and the robot would.
And the robot would. So, Fred, so you'd be able to come up with a plan to make it move and give it arms and fingers and all, in a vision system and speech synthesis even. But how about, okay, so how are you going to go about making it self-aware? What are the engineers that you've got, your team you've assembled?
Huh? Self-aware?
What are you going to do to make this robot realize that it exists? How did this start?
This was already a hard project. Now you're making it impossible. I think I would send an email to God.
an email to God. What is the first step in your algorithm? Okay, we've got this humanoid shape thing, this C-3PO or Data, some motors and all, and some computer technology. But what's the first step on making it self-aware, bringing it to consciousness? Fred, we don't even know how to think about the problem. We there is no first step. Like if we had all the money in the world, or better yet, all the energy in the universe, we were ultimately powerful and wealthy, and we had every brain on earth, we wouldn't know where to start. We can't describe the solution to the problem. We just can't describe it.
That's right. And that's, you know, kind of say tongue in cheek, send an email to God, but it's pretty powerful evidence that you need God
to have consciousness.
That's right.
Right. If somebody said, could you take your son's treehouse and put it on the moon? Well, that'd be really hard, but you'd be able to sit down and write the steps of what you'd have to do to accomplish that.
Yeah.
In fact, you could probably do that in 15 minutes. And say, first we have to do this, then this, then this, then this. And when we do all these things, it'd be hard, it'd be expensive, then my kid's treehouse would be on the moon.
Yeah. But to make that treehouse conscious, or a tree conscious, I know Al Gore would love that, hug a tree.
Right.
Have it hugging back.
They never hug back, do they? Okay, so that's a great article, Robots Will Not Take Over the World, by Carl Wieland, with Creation Ministries International, quoting Noel Sharkey, one of the world's leading artificial intelligence researchers. He says it's a fairy tale, and he says it has nothing to do with how fast the computer is. It's computational power that's completely irrelevant to the issue of consciousness.
Yeah, and he's probably an evolutionist, but in this case, he's being intellectually honest, and candor's costing him a lot of problems with his colleagues.
Yeah, and good.
Yeah.
So, hey, Fred, there are articles in this magazine about living fossils. And these are interesting because you could fill a book. Wait, it has been done. You can fill a book with living fossils. And there are fossils that supposedly things that were extinct millions of years ago that we find walking around or growing in a forest or swimming in the ocean. And then there are other things that, even though they're known to be alive, they're in the fossil record supposedly millions and millions of years ago, and they look identical.
They do. And in this edition, they give an example of something called a shovel nose ray. So that's a kind of stingray.
A shovel nose ray.
Yeah.
Okay.
And they, you know, the evolutionists claim that this thing, well, they have a fossil that looks just like a modern-day shovel-nose ray. Mm-hmm. They claim the fossil is from a creature 148 million years ago.
Well, in fact, that fossil is in Pittsburgh at the Carnegie Museum of Natural History. So they say it's 148 million years old.
That's right. And in the magazine, they give a picture of the fossil, and then they show a picture of a living shovel-nose ray. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that we definitely recommend that our listening audience buy this magazine so that they can see all the great graphics and pictures they provide. And I know you sell it through your store.
Well, we provide a link right to creation.com for people to subscribe on their own because it's so great. People need to do that. At Denver Bible Church, Fred, two Sundays ago, we were urging people, make sure the Creation magazine comes to your home.
Absolutely.
Because it is so great. And maybe for Christmas, get a subscription to someone else. Or, you know, we're getting close to Christmas, but at Bob and Yart Live, we have a science department with really, really fun gifts for Christmas.
Yeah, and this is a very well done magazine. And, a picture is worth a thousand words in this case. And these creatures are identical, yet one of them, the evolutionists claim, is 148 million years old, and yet there's virtually no change in that period of time. There's no evolution whatsoever.
And Fred, what's so interesting is that mutations are real.
They are.
Just like erosion, and they're ruthless.
So you're going to have a slight some variety in a certain kind of animal, right?
Yeah, and through generations, through centuries, just in the last centuries and thousands of years, there's been tremendous diversity in species and kinds of animals around the world. And to think with so many examples, like in amber, where they have insects that are identical to modern insects, and even their behavior, they can tell by looking even the behavior of these social insects and all are identical to the behavior today. And they say, look at that. Amazing. It didn't change in 100 million years.
Yeah. And for these things to stay so remarkably similar, even for just maybe 20,000 years, seems unlikely. And evolutionists apparently realize that, too, because they classify them in a different genus.
Right, because it's awkward for them to think that you got the same species today as you had 150 million years ago.
That's right.
It's just awkward. So it's fun. And what we know is it wasn't 150 million years ago. Just like soft tissue T-Rex, we've got T-Rex fossils with soft tissue in them, just like we have hadrosaurs and all, duck-billed dinosaurs. And they're now at Harvard sequencing the proteins of dinosaurs. Come on, they got living bacteria from millions of years ago. It's all too much, Fred. It stretches the imagination beyond the breaking point. The Earth is young. All these things are not millions of years old. They're recent.
Yeah, this evidence fits a young Earth perspective, the biblical perspective. It
yes.
does not fit a millions and millions of years
no.
of decay and, you know, death. It doesn't
Mutation.
Fit that model at all.
So there's another similar article in here, but about these birds, not about a stingray, but about these flightless birds from New Guinea. And Fred, this is interesting. It's very similar, but now we've gone from the sea to the land. And this is a cassowary.
A cassowary. So this is a type of flightless bird.
Yeah, flightless birds, and there are other kinds of flightless birds.
Yeah, there's
right?
emus and ostriches, and what else? Let's see, there's...
Well, there's a cassowary.
There's a cassowary.
That's right.
There's the New Zealand's kiwi.
A kiwi. And so, not the fruit.
Not the fruit.
But
yeah, the fruit
bird.
Can't fly either.
That's right. And so, these, they say, lived about 40 to 70 million years ago, but the modern species is virtually unchanged from the fossils that have been found. And so they're labeled as living fossils. And they give an example like the Wollemi pine. It was thought that the Wollemi pine tree went extinct many, many millions of years ago. And there they find one living.
Lo and behold, there's one still extant today, still existing today,
right.
alive.
So it went extinct, whatever, 30 million years ago, but there was always just one.
Just one hanging around.
Hanging around. And so today,
passing
just
on its father's genes.
Right. You know. And the reality is God created the earth in the recent past less than 10,000 years ago. And so all these things become eminently understandable and are virtually predicted by the creation model, whereas they're just shocking from the evolutionary model, and that's normally what they say. We're so shocked to find these things.
And boy, they say that a lot, because there's a lot of examples, and like you said, there's already been a book written about all these living fossils.
Living fossils, that's right. And that book is by Dr. Carl Werner, and it's a great book available at creation.com. So, Fred, these here cassowaries, these are flightless birds, and there are other kinds too. You know, evolutionists have been supposing that all these flightless birds, they all evolved from the same ancestor. Now enter microbiology, and the genetic research is suggesting actually, no, they're not.
So they're not related to like ostriches and emus.
Well, right. There's serious problems in their claim and their belief that, well, they must have all evolved from one another. Turns out, no. Now, humans, you know, have evolved from sponges.
Yeah, we learned that last week.
That's right.
So you got to listen to last week's show to find out that we're 70% similar to a sponge.
That's right. And so if you check out, for example, physorg.com, September 2008, new research challenges long-held assumptions of flightless bird evolution. So it turns out, no, these are just birds, different kinds of birds that God created, and they lost their ability to fly. And in this article, Fred, it's so interesting, they talk about how that may have happened. And they say in part of the world, like in Indonesia, New Guinea, in Australia, parts of the world that it was harder for land-dwelling animals to get to, there were birds that got there first as animals began to disperse around the world. beginning from the Middle East.
So the author here talks about the tropical thicket of how it can make it hard maybe for these birds to take off. Is it possible that, because creationists agree that natural selection occurs.
Oh, yeah, right.
But it's a conservation mechanism. It can only work with pre-existing genes.
It conserves. It doesn't create.
That's
it
right.
It conserves. You have to have a protein before natural selection could select it. And so, Fred, right, so you've got forest and rainforest, but also you don't have predators.
That's right.
You don't have land-dwelling predators that can kill these birds. So normally a bird taking off and flying away from a predator is a tremendous survival mechanism. But when there are no such predators, then that ability to take off and fly isn't going to make it more likely that your descendants will have a better chance of survival than others that cannot fly.
That's right. So some of the offspring are going to have, we're not positive on this, but
right.
likely had a mutation that it couldn't fly. But that's going to favor them to in some degree because it's not the flight isn't necessary.
The flight is not necessary for them to survive and reproduce.
Yeah, and over time they take over the population.
Right.
Like
on an island, a simple example is on a windy island, beetles that fly tend to die out because they're flying
exactly.
and the wind blows them out to sea, whereas a beetle that has had a mutation and it cannot fly, it's on the ground and a lot safer when it gets windy, so you end up with islands where all the beetles can't fly compared to their flying cousins.
And you said a key word earlier, they lost the ability to fly.
They lost.
So what is evolution? Is it losing things or is it gaining things?
I'm going to lose it. If I get another caller that says, hey, Richard Dawkins gives us all the evidence for evolution. Now, of course, he claims he does now in his latest book, Fred. But what's fun about that is Dr. Jonathan Sarfati has written a brilliant rebuttal called The Greatest Hoax on Earth. And we've interviewed Dr. Sarfati, and you could go to kgov.com, click on Real Science Friday, and you'll see it right there in the best of Real Science Friday shows.
Yeah, and he's a very good writer, very good scientist.
Yeah, he's really great. Okay, so how about this? There's been a search going on for a long time for Noah's Ark.
They finally found it.
They did?
It's in this magazine. It's an actual picture of Noah's Ark. They
actual,
found it.
Full-size Noah's Ark. Where is it at Mount Ararat?
Well, no. It says in the Bible the mountains of Ararat.
That's right.
I wonder if that includes Hong Kong.
No, Hong Kong is in the wrong part of the world, but we're just joshing here. But Fred, turns out there's a full-size Noah's Ark in Hong Kong, right at the side of a major highway going to one of the world's busiest airports.
That's right, and it's got the exact size and dimensions as given in the Bible. And here we have Noah's Ark, and it's become a big tourist attraction in Hong Kong.
Yeah.
And what's great, according to this article, you know, Carl Wieland of Creation Ministries International, who produces this magazine, he actually went and visited it, and he was skeptical at first, but he went there and he's like, hey, this thing is awesome. The production is tremendous, and they provide biblical truths during the tour.
Yeah, a number of the services provided and the exhibits on the Ark are run by evangelical Christians who are sharing the truth of God's word. So it's really fun. And boy, talk about an eyeful. Even just looking at it, of course, you could go online and Google Hong Kong's Noah's Ark, but the photographs are just gorgeous. And so this will give people an idea of the size of Noah's Ark, and it's just awesome. And certainly the animals could fit on the Ark.
Oh, they could.
There is no question. What we know about the way animals reproduce and diversify and the size of the ark easily, and the average animal on the ark would have been about the size of maybe, a squirrel.
That's right. You don't need to take full-grown animals onto the ark. You can take juvenile, even dinosaurs. Dinosaurs would have been on the ark, elephants, giraffes.
Mm-hmm.
And, one of the most common straw man arguments that evolutionists say is, how did Noah get all those species on the ark? You didn't need to take species. You can take different kinds of animals. There's like, what, 15 different kinds of North American jackrabbits? You don't need to take all those species on the ark.
No.
They're only classified as different species because they became separated in their populations and developed different mating habits.
Right, and similar with dogs. You don't have to bring all the different kinds of dog, German Shepherds and Chihuahuas.
That's right. And creation scientists have done studies on Noah's Ark, and you would only need to fill up Noah's Ark with about 15% of its space with animals to populate the earth with all the types
15%.
Of animals we have now. Roughly 15% of the ark is all that would be needed.
Because there's a feasibility study on Noah's Ark that's really cool.
There is, by John Woodmoran.
And there are hundreds of examples in the cultures of the world of stories. There's a collective recollection in humanity that there was a giant flood that destroyed life, and a few survived on a vessel of some kind, along with animals.
Yeah. Like the Chinese language, and I confirmed this with my manager where I work, she's Chinese, that the Chinese language, if you break out characters, for example, the word for boat in Chinese, if you separate out the character, is eight people.
Eight people.
And I asked her that, and she confirmed that, that's
mouths.
Right.
Eight mouths to feed,
yes.
Even.
Yes.
And a vessel. A vessel, like it could be
a vessel on your kitchen table.
But it's a vessel and eight mouths. It's so fun. Fred. Hey, we're out of time, but could I tell people about this? You know the DVDs we sell? Now, somebody could get this. If you're running out of time and you have somebody who likes science and you'd like to get them a gift for Christmas, we sell Unlocking the Mystery of Life, DVD, The Privileged Planet, and Darwin's Dilemma on the Cambrian Explosion.
And those are tremendous videos, very well produced.
Really
highly recommend
great.
Them.
All from the Intelligent Design Movement, which is not explicitly Christian, but very valuable for studying science. In fact, Lord willing, we'll be interviewing William Dembski real soon as one of the leaders of the Intelligent Design Movement. But we've got all three of these DVDs in a beautiful box set, and this is for $50. And Fred, normally this is $75 here at Bob and Yurt Live. So $50, but you have to call in to get it. Call in 303-463-7789, 303-463-7789, or 800-8-N-YARTS. Either way, the Intelligent Design Collection for Christmas, it's a box set of all three. You'll love it.
Yeah, and the videos I have always highly recommended.
Yeah. So, hey, thank you, Fred Williams. Another episode of Real Science Friday.
Thanks, Bob.
Love having you in the studio, Fred. And, of course, we do Bob and Yurt Live all week here at KGOV.com. May God bless you.
Hey, science fans. Now you can have all of the Real Science Friday shows on MP3 CD from 2007, 2008, or 2009. Hear Bob and Fred present the compelling scientific evidence that the Earth is young and that there is a creator. Real Science Friday 2007, 2008, and 2009 are each available by calling 1-800-8-NYART. Or you can get the MP3 CDs or the MP3 downloads at kgovstore.com.